from WNYC New York Public Radio. This is the podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show. This is just one segment of the program. You can hear all Leonard's interviews on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
This July and August, I'll be talking about underappreciated and forgotten works of great literature as part of a special summer reading series on my show. Today, we will discuss why some books fall in and out of fashion and print. And joining me now are Michael Redhill, publisher of the literary magazine Brick and the editor of a book called Lost Classics, writers on books loved and lost, overlooked, underread, unavailable, stolen, extinct, or otherwise out of commission. And Edwin Frank is here, editor for the New York Review of Books Classics series, and I'm very pleased to welcome them both to my show today. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Michael, when you were editing Lost Classics, did you define what a classic was to your contributors?
We didn't. You know, we approached writers and readers alike, and we asked them all to think on a book that they wish they could still get their hands on to pass around to people because they loved it, whether it inspired them or it just stayed in their minds or in any fashion influenced them. We just wanted them to reach back into their brain pans and pick something out that they felt was forgotten for no good reason. And so they wrote in on a variety of books, and they surprised us immensely with their choices.
The reason I ask is I was wondering whether a classic has to have been respected or widely read at one time, or can something be a classic that never got much acclaim or attention, but that we realize should have?
Well, absolutely. I believe that's so, because a book is a very private thing. And a person's relationship with a book is something that happens, you know, outside of the world of book sales and reviews and what have you. It's not about a book's acceptance in the wider world, I think, but rather how it affects an individual.
Edwin, do you agree? You have a series you call Classic Series.
Yeah, I think I do agree, and I've said in a little book we did about, you know, collecting introductions that various people had written to the books in the series, that this was less about kind of the looming landmarks of literature than the trails that people had sort of blazed through the woods on their own. And so, yeah, I think we're certainly interested in books that are good books that people have a deep connection to.
So there's a lot of subjectivity in these choices.
Inevitably. I mean, I sometimes find myself saying they're chosen rigorously by whim.
How little read does a book have to be now to qualify as underappreciated or forgotten?
Well, that's a hard thing to say. I mean, certainly in the list, there are books that very few people know of at all, and others that may be, in fact, very much established classics in other cultures, in other languages, and so on. And so I suppose there's no obvious, cutoff point. I guess it's an intuitive sense that is this a book that has something to say now, more to say than people perhaps have given it credit for.
But, Michael, an underappreciated novel might still be more widely read than the work of many contemporary poets.
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely relative, for sure. The fact is that, sometimes when you have 10 readers for a book, that's absolutely, you know, the best case scenario for that book, not because it's not worthy of a wider readership, but because those 10 people appreciate it better than, you know, I'm sure the author may not feel this way, but those people really appreciate the book for what it's worth. They're what you might call fit readers. But books disappear for all kinds of reasons. Most of them things that have nothing to do with business, but more to do, I suppose, with fashion. And when a book is written, it's not just speaking to its contemporary audience. It's hopefully speaking to a future audience as well. And sometimes that future audience wakes up to that book long after the time that it was written in.
Well, I have a fairly long list of books that I have cherished that I know other people are unaware of, and I wonder if there isn't a certain glamour to loving a book that others don't know about.
Oh, for sure. Like, it's just wonderful to be able to say to someone, have you read such and such? And they go, who? What? and you go, oh my God, and
you
run
don't
into
know?
The library and you say, this is the only copy in existence, I'm almost certain of it. And you say, I will lend this to you, but I'm coming to live at your house while you read it because I want it back. And you know, it just the notion of a book as a cherished object as well as a cherished memory is something that is wonderful to share with people who love literature.
Yeah, and then of course inevitably there are those books that you know we love for reasons we can't quite figure out ourselves, and that's always a sort of interesting thing to see how other people respond to them. You press it into their hands, and they may have a totally different take on it.
Yeah. The way you read is a form of autobiography, I think, and what you love says something about you, and it may be the only way you have of communicating, you know, one of the only ways you have of communicating who you are to other people by saying, listen, I can't explain it, but read this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, I think that's very true.
Well, there was a book that I remembered with great fondness from years ago, Ali and Nino, and then nobody knew what it was. And then a biography was written recently of the strange author of that book, and I felt confirmed. Unfortunately, it turns out I like the book less now than I did before.
Yeah, popularity can certainly change your attitude towards a book, especially if you know you feel that you've been alone propping it up. Then suddenly everybody says, "Yeah, it is great," and you go, "Oh, I got to find another waif somewhere."
Edwin, how do you go about finding a lost classic for your series?
Well, in various different ways. There are people who suggest things all the time. I mean, the sort of thing we've been talking about—people who say this is a book that I love more than anything. There are news events that make people think of books that that they think, you know, would be particularly that are old but would be current. I spend a lot of time in used bookstores and not so much the I like the ones with lots of dog-eared paperbacks more than the ones with nicely wrapped old hardcovers, because it tells you about a moment in book culture which is kind of sadly lost, which was a moment when really quite good books and all sorts of other books all mingled in the mass market paperback. And you could get a kind of a whole range of different things books could be, from true crime to great literature, which is in some sense, I think, finally the source of the interest of reading. It is that kind of promiscuous mix.
Is one of your criterions that the book has to be out of print?
Most of the time. It depends. Some books in the public domain are not out of print, but they are so unavailable that they might as well be.
Michael, can you give us examples of books that were once really popular but have gone out of fashion in our own lifetimes?
Well, one thing that comes to mind immediately, just because Bloomsbury in England has picked up on it, is Charles Portis's books. They're just re-releasing True Grit in England an introduction by Donna Tartt, and I mean, he was actually, to tell you the honest truth, a writer I didn't know about at all. He also wrote a novel called The Dog. I think it was called The Dog of the South or From the South, and it may make me appear to be less read than I'd like to appear, but I didn't know the man, and I've now started to read these books again, and I'm thrilled that they've been brought to my attention.
Of course, he's from the United States. You're from Canada. I'm sure there are some Canadian writers who are much better known in Canada than the United States. And that is a major determinant, isn't it? There are some writers who are still very famous in their home countries and not known in the United States, in Canada, in Britain, France, whatever.
Oh, it's absolutely true. I mean, you think of a writer like Orhan Pamuk, you know, whose novel Snow has made him a major name now internationally. But he was, you know, one of the most famous writers in his country for many years. And he was also in translation. It just took, there's something, you know, like the 100th Monkey effect that allows a book to finally cross the transom into other people's imaginations. And then there's an explosion. And you think, my God, this person has how many books under his belt? Where has he been all my life? You know, it just something needs to tip things over, and you never know what it's going to be. Like Edwin is saying, it could be a new political reality, a change in fashion. You never know.
Yeah, the language barrier remains a huge barrier, especially for readers of English. It's tremendously difficult to get works translated, and all sorts of things, classics. beloved books that are from other countries and so on, we are still not really available in this country.
But do you think there's also cultural differences? For example, a writer like Machado de Assis, mm-hmm. who is considered one of the great writers of Latin America, and he is translated every time a new translation comes out. The New York Times Book Review declares him one of the greatest writers in the history of the world. And yet, I'm willing to bet that mm-hmm. 98% of all the people listening right now never heard of Machado de Assis.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I'm not. I mean, I think that there's always people, of course, are focused, and booksellers are focused, and on what's coming out now and the new thing. That's just an inevitable feature of any, I think, any society's reality. But I think also there is the difficulty of, there's a sort of anxiety that one won't get it. And the past, well, the past is a sort of foreign country, and the past of a foreign country is really, really a foreign country. And so I think people are reluctant or uncertain in exploring those areas.
I think of a writer like the French writer Juan Echanoz, who won the Prix Goncourt for I'm Gone, a book that's readily available in English. And he has a long list of books under his belt, many of which have been translated, and still nobody knows of him. You can press a book into somebody's hand, and they'll read it cover to cover and go, holy cow, is he ever amazing. It's just, you know, like I was saying before, it's a steep, steep climb for any writer in translation. And I think, you know, you have to win major prizes, if not the Nobel Prize, before you start attracting attention. And I think it's very rare that the writer in translation gets the accolades outside of his country while he or she is still alive.
What about the role of academia? The canon is constantly being revised and questioned. Does this tend to open up the possibility of saving lost works, or, on the other hand, of burying some? For example, Thomas Mann seems to have been replaced by Franz Kafka in every course of 20th century literature. Does that make Thomas Mann no good anymore?
Oh, not at all. That's a great pity, because Mann is really a wonderful novelist, and it's a pity he's been come to be seen as this sort of glum German, when something like Buddenbrooks is one of the great funny family novels, as well as a tragic one, but a really wonderful one. So I'm always actually very, that I find that a depressing development.
But it seems to me that we have to substitute one writer for another one. We can't embrace them all.
Well, that's a pity too, that there can only be one German writer or one, you know, Portuguese writer or what you will. That's a terrible narrowing.
But isn't there also a trend away from difficult books? I mean, Mann is, in fact, a much more difficult writer than Kafka is, and I think perhaps, you know, in the ever despairing world of academe, perhaps there's an urge to put something more with more fireworks into the coursework rather than something as difficult as a book like Buddenbrooks.
I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I agree that Mann is actually more difficult than Kafka.
Dr. Faustus and Dr. Joseph Faustus. And His Brothers.
Yeah,
they're pretty difficult books.
Yeah, but Death in Venice, and I think Buddenbrooks is, you know, there with George Eliot. But the influence of academia is a funny. George Eliot may be on the verge of being a forgotten writer too, for that matter. The influence of academia is a funny.
You're banging something.
Sorry. Okay. The influence of academia is a funny business, because on the one hand, yes, it has sort of helped to open up things. And I think, the most obvious example of that are works outside of the Western tradition, and perhaps most of all works by women novelists who really were not much paid attention to for a while, or at least a whole range of considered lesser novelists. And the example there's the great publishing program that Virago has run that brought back all sorts of, in many cases, really fascinating writers. On the other hand, teachers have to budget their time as much as anybody, and I think there is a certain desire to sort of settle on a few good things and keep coming back to them again and again. And of course, there's a question of what really matters.
And then there's also the matter of whether there's a good translation of a book. Some very great books have been issued only in poor translations, and publishers are reluctant to have them retranslated because they cost a lot of money. They may not sell any more books.
Right. Well, Rilke certainly comes to mind in that frame when you think about how long it was until the Stephen Mitchell translation of those poems came out, and finally you read them without casting aspersions on people who translated Rilke beforehand. But I think it took to Stephen Mitchell before people went, oh my God, listen to this music. And even before then, you know, you could acknowledge that Rilke was a great poet, but you didn't really have the full picture until Mitchell came along. You know, one other thing I want to say about the academe, though, is that I'm not entirely convinced that there's a direct correlation between what is being read in universities and what your average, you know, book lover is interested in. I find the two worlds sometimes quite divorced from each other. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that one creates tastes in the other.
I think that's quite true, though. I wonder about the kids coming up through the schools in some sense. I think their sense of what matters or the kind of map they might have for going out and looking farther in later years is affected by what they run into with their teachers. And you know, if they come out of the school sufficiently interested to go out and look around on their own, well, that's perfect.
Absolutely. But then you have the filter of the way a book is taught that really influences how people think about books. I think there's a big difference, of course, between picking up a book because you're interested and embarking on a relationship with that book and having a book demonstrated or taught or parsed for you. In fact, obviously, the opposite is true. You know, the possibility of becoming a great reader can be destroyed for you by having a bad teacher.
Yeah.
What do you think about the Internet? Do you think it's playing a role in reviving underappreciated books?
I don't know. I think it might be having a role in creating an appetite for antiquarian books. I mean, I always see these days at least, I see the Internet as a place of commerce more than anything. And certainly if you want to find a lost classic, a great place, you know, there's a few great places you can go on the Internet. But so far in my experience, I haven't seen the Internet as a really rich place for a discourse about literature.
Do you have a favorite lost classic that you tend to recommend?
Oh, God, it just sort of depends what mood I'm in. In fact, I'm actually drawing a blank on that because it feels like it changes every week for me.
Edwin, are there certain books that you tend to recommend?
Well, there are books that in the course of doing this 150 or so books in the series that we've got have been real discoveries for me, writers I hadn't really known or at all or only by name. And amongst those, of course, I'm you know, sort of recommending my own product at this point, which is bad form. But I was delighted to discover a book by the Italian-Sicilian writer Leonardo Sciascia called To Each His Own, which is sort of a detective novel, but it's actually a very serious book, and it packs a real punch at the end. A short, very, very powerful book.
Two writers that I talk about quite regularly is one is Stanley Elkin, who mm-hmm. I think is what people unfortunately call a writer's writer, mm-hmm. and who's, you know, extremely popular among those who love him and completely unknown otherwise. Has a huge oeuvre. He died a few years ago, as I'm sure you both know. But his novel, The Franchiser, I think is one of the great comic novels of the 20th century, and not only is little read, but is very, very difficult to find. There's also the habit at times of telling people, oh, don't read that series of book by that writer, read this one. And in this case, for me, I love Patricia Highsmith, but I don't think very many people read outside of the Ripley books.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, The Price of Salt and The Tremor of Forgery are, you know, her two best books, and no one knows about them.
There's one called A Dog's Ransom that I think is really wonderful, too. Yeah.
I want to thank you both for helping us kick off this series, Michael Redhill, publisher of the literary magazine Brick and editor of a book called Lost Classics, Writers on Books Loved and Lost, Overlooked, Underread, Unavailable, Stolen, Extinct, or Otherwise Out of Commission, and also Edwin Frank, who's the editor for the New York Review of Books' classic series, which includes some of the most wonderful books that fit that description of underread, unavailable, stolen, extinct, etc., etc. Thank you both so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for checking out today's podcast of The Leonard LoPage Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.